Morning, everyone. I'd like to call the House Legacy Finance Division Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. It's nice to be back. Certainly missed everybody and looking forward to the session, working together on all the things that are in our world here and with Legacy. Of course, most of our work was last session, but we're ready to hit the road this year. I have a new legislative assistant here. Mr. O'Neill, would you be willing to call roll?
Of course, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly.
Here.
Representative Jordan.
Jordan present.
Representative Green. Representative Ackholm.
Present.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson present.
Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Hassan.
Present.
Representative Murphy.
Murphy present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Erdahl.
Erdahl present.
Representative Wazlowick.
Wazlowick present.
Representative Zhang. Representative Green. Representative Zhang. Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. We have a quorum, so we're open for business. I welcome everyone. Vice Chair Jordan, would you be willing to move our minutes from our April 7th, 2021 meeting?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes from April 7th, 2021.
Thank you. Any questions to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Hearing none, we have the minutes approved. Thank you, Vice Chair Jordan. Well, welcome everyone. Welcome back. I kind of made it sound right off the get-go that we don't have a lot to do. We actually do. I think this session provides us a great opportunity to really look at some of the work we've done and some of the impacts of COVID and, you know, really check in with who's recipients of our money. And then we will have a large bill that has come through Lessard Sams. You know, they've been working on that all along here, and that'll be moving forward. And then I would imagine there's some minor tweaks or major tweaks that we can do, and hoping to work with all of you and certainly the folks across the street to meet the challenges of today. I just want to, I think that's, I don't know if we have any questions right from members. I had an opportunity to talk to the GOP lead yesterday. I'm sure he's catching up, but we had a good conversation, and he's very interested in what we're doing, and Representative Green. So with that, I think we're just going to kind of hop right in. We have we're going to hear from some folks that are, you know, that have been recipients of legacy funds, and then kind of hear some of the impacts of what's going on with the current world and what COVID means to them, and some of the financial impacts of what's going on. So we, let's see, I think I'm gonna start, we've asked a nonpartisan staff, our STAR team there, Mr. Hagemeyer and Ms. Roberts, to come in and kind of tell us where we're at, because I think that's important to kind of know what the deck of cards is, you know, with the forecasts. And we all know that there's another forecast coming out real soon, so we'll have better numbers. But so that's kind of what we're thinking. And so if Mr. Hagemeyer, if you're first, or Ms. Roberts, go ahead when you're ready, please.
Mr. Chair, I can talk to this if that's okay. Let me pull the screen back up. So I just wanted to give you guys an update of where the funds are at based on the November forecast. And just so everyone is aware, they'll be changing again, in the February forecast, either positively or negatively, we don't know yet. That is set for the end of the month when we get the new forecast. Since last year, there's been a lot of changes. The funds are up quite a bit. We always calculate a 5% reserve based in statute. That's how much is required, a minimum amount that's meant to be meant to be set aside so that we can account for some of those little changes in forecasts. That's this amount here. That is based off the tax receipt number. So you see this line here of tax receipts, which are up. And then I should say for each of the funds, there's actually like 7 different number changes that account for the overall change that you see. So the tax receipt numbers in fiscal year 21 changed, and then those rolled forward into 22. And then the tax receipt numbers for 22 changed, and the tax receipt numbers for 23 changed. And those should all be proportional across all 4 funds. The other change would be the investment income. That also changed for fiscal years 21, 22, and 23. Those are not proportional because the amount of balance in each fund, Outdoor Heritage Fund, it takes a little bit longer for the projects to fully spend their money. So there's a usually larger balance in the fund. So it has the larger amount of investment income. Like comparatively, you'll see it's $1.3 million in for Outdoor Heritage Fund. Well, it's only $650,000 for Clean Water Fund, and those both receive the same amount of tax money. So you can see the investment income is different for each of those. And then the last piece would be any cancellations, because fiscal year 21 is now closed as of June 30th. Any amounts that would have canceled would have dropped to the bottom line and rolled forward into fiscal year 22 as a balance forward here. And then those are kind of disproportionate across the funds to Clean Water Fund, I think typically has the largest amount of cancellations. So with that, you'll see there's an available balance in, and this would be a biennial total number in the box here. If there were, technically you could spend money in fiscal year 22, that would be this amount, but it is not cumulative of the two. It'd just be this is the overall number you could spend. Outdoor Heritage Fund has an available balance of $156,749,000. I believe the recommendations coming from Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council spend $155 million and change and leave about a 6% reserve. I don't know if that bill has been introduced yet, but I believe that's the recommendations that they have. Moving on to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, you can see there's $9.8 million that would be an available balance if people wanted to do something with it. Clean Water Fund has $43.6 million. And then the Parks and Trails Fund has just under $5 million available. And I just would like to note that if these are not spent, that's perfectly fine as well. They would just roll forward into fiscal year 24 and then could be spent next session. They don't go away or anything like that. So that is the total amount that is available in each fund and kind of the numbers that go into it. If anyone has any questions, I can try to answer those.
Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer. I do see a question. We have a question from Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. Hagemeyer, just talk a little bit about that investment income. Who does that, and is it rolled into the reserve then, or the balance before reserve?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, so the investment income is the amount, I think it's just held at MMB and invested with other funds basically. But since there's, you know, there's probably close to $200 million in the Outdoor Heritage Fund at a given point in time. So every day that's just accruing some interest. And these are estimated amounts for fiscal year 22 and 23. And then past years would have been an actual amount. And those just go into the total resource number available here, which is the balance forward in from previous years, the new tax receipts, and then the estimated income, investment income, all go into this number. And that's the total we're basing the spending off of, but the 5% reserve number is just based off of the tax receipt number based on statute. Okay. So it's just a small amount of interest that the account receives basically on being held at MMB.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Hagemeyer, then it's kept for the particular fund. And so our total for legacy doesn't grow. It's stays with the Outdoor Heritage or the Clean Water or the Parks and Trail Fund, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is correct. Yep, the funds are dedicated to the individual accounts or individual funds that they would have accrued to. So it's not just a separate legacy fund. They go to Outdoor Heritage Fund, Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, Clean Water Fund, and Parks and Trails Fund. They go to their separate funds.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. And there's no way to change the bottom line of any of the funds. Is that correct?
I don't know if that's a question for Mr. Hagemeyer.
That goes back to the original amounts that each fund, the percentage of each that each fund would receive of the total amount. Is that correct?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think in any substantial way of changing, yeah, the percentage allocation that's dedicated by Constitution, I don't know about investment income. Since they're appropriated, we can't really also invest them to get more money available. So it would be the only way you could change the bottom line, I guess, would be to spend or not spend money in those accounts. But actually, the dedicated receipts are already dedicated, so you can't change those right at this time based on the Constitution.
One can always dream. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just wondering what your intent is going forward with this money. Outdoor Heritage, we do the second year of the biennium. Being that there is some money available in the other categories, is it your intent to do a bill reflecting that? Or are you going to wait until your negotiations with the Senate on that topic?
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. That's it's kind of the big question of the session. I'm hoping to meet with Senator Rood and see if she has an appetite to meet some of the current challenges. I know you have mentioned one that came to your mind or came to you recently, and I've heard from a few other folks that might have some interest in some projects. Yeah, there is, I know Lessard Sams was able to adjust their proposal, 12%, I think it was, Mr. Hagemeyer, roughly, you know, from their original proposal to kind of meet the changing numbers. But we're certainly hoping to have some discussion and see the appetite. Historically, there has not been an appetite in the Senate to do anything on some of these other funds. But as you can see, there's quite a bit of money that could be out doing good work, especially like in the clean water area. I mean, it's a huge number. And certainly we're going to hear in a few seconds from some of these arts and cultural groups that are, you know, seeing some challenges. So maybe this money could help, you know, in certain situations, you know, adding to some of the work they're doing. Or even parks and trails, you can add or improve a couple of trails around the state, how, you know, with the high demand and on these systems. So anyways, I know I'm kind of singing to some of the choir here, but you know, we're gonna try to move the efforts forward, and I'm actually hopeful that we can maybe do something. There's always going to be like language changes that, you know, that different groups need, you know, maybe an extension or something. So there's certainly going to be that, but I think there needs to be a monetary discussion as well. It's a long answer, but a great question. So is that any further questions for Mr. Hagemeyer? Or I think Ms. Roberts was here too. And they're certainly available to members at any time. They're just incredible. We're so blessed to have great staff that nonpartisan and partisan that are working on these subject areas. So I don't see any further questions. Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer and Ms. Roberts, and thank you, members, for the questions. So we're going to kind of go move into the area of kind of hearing some updates from what, like in our arts community, of what the impacts of your events or what's kind of happened since last session. So I'm going to start off with Ms. Stoller Stearns. Oh, there you are. Okay, sorry. So if you're, please introduce yourself and kind of tell us your story. Thank you for coming this morning.
Sure. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be joining you. My name is Amy Stearns, and I manage the Historic Homes Theater, which is an 800-seat performing arts center in beautiful Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. And we are a part of a larger nonprofit called the Detroit Lakes Community and Cultural Center. And if I can, I'm going to try to share my screen. So let's see, is that a possibility to do?
Mr. Molzon, do we?
Yep, she should be able to share her screen.
Okay.
There we go. Can you see?
Awesome. Yep.
Presentation? Okay, great. So we are the Historic Homes Theater, and it's part of the Detroit Lakes Community and Cultural Center. We have a huge facility, about 120,000 square feet of great activities that we do throughout our building all the time, from fitness classes to unbelievable performances and art classes and so many great things going on in our building. So as you can imagine, with the shuttering of both the performing arts side of our building and the fitness and aquatics center of our building, this is what we looked like. We had empty parking lots, empty stage, just empty. It was heartbreaking, and it was anything but normal. This is normally who we are. We are full. We have about anywhere, depending on the time of year, 600 to 800 people a day who come through our building, performing arts shows, coming to shows like that, little kids in basketball, older adults doing yoga, you name it, it goes on here. We are truly the social hub for Detroit Lakes and for Becker County. And this is not normal. This is what we did the past couple of years. We pivoted, we created, we had so much virtual classes, virtual interactions. We are the happy and lucky recipients of quite a few different legacy grants. And we were able to spin those and do outreach still with schools all the way from Manoman and Waban Ogama on the White Earth Indian Reservation, down to Pelican Rapids, Frazee, Perham, Detroit Lakes, of course, Lake Park, Audubon. We serve all those communities. And we did a lot of Zoom. We did a lot of online fitness classes. It was just incredible. And people turned out for them. It was great. That part was great. But the impact on us was huge. We lost 70% of the revenue for the Homes Theater, overall 30% for the whole organization. Staffing, we went from 150 employees down to just a meager 15 employees. We've been very carefully adding employees back for the past year. Bit by bit, many, many, many of them are part-time employees. And so we're at about 95 right now. And this includes fitness instructors and that too, and some art teachers and that sort of thing. And the costs have been huge with a new air filtration system, protective equipment, limiting attendance, limiting the number of people who can come to shows. But of all things, as heartbreaking as it was for us as an organization, it was even more heartbreaking on our community because we are truly the social hub of the community. There's that isolation people have had to deal with when they couldn't come here. There's the fear of coming back, even though people are getting vaccinated, people are wearing masks, all of that. There's still a group that are very, very hesitant to get back involved in anything. And the impact on our community. I mean, when we have a show or an event at the Homes, people tell me that the restaurants are just packed. They have to staff up because there's so many people going out for dinner and getting involved in our community and staying in hotels and all of that. So the economic impact that the Homes and the entire DLCCC has on Detroit Lakes and Becker County is extraordinary. So what comes next? None of us really know. You know, of course we don't really know, but we have dreams. We want to be better than we've ever been. We have so many great ideas of things that we can do, but we definitely need the help and the support. We need the continued support from the great programming from the State Arts Board with Legacy Amendment grants and opportunities that we can tap into there. Any other support we can receive from the state, for whether it's for the arts or for fitness, we definitely need the support. And of course, grants, foundations, business sponsorships, and individual support will help us get through this and be better than we've ever been, because we want to get back to that. We want to get back to serving our community, having full theaters, having people in the pool, and doing what we do best, which is bring our community together and serve this region of Minnesota. Thank you so much. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Stearns. I think we're going to hold questions till all four of you are done, but thank you for telling your story. You sure got me excited to get out and see some of those performances, and kind of maybe want to stretch too or whatever.
Come on up. We'd love to have you. We have lots going on this weekend in Detroit Lakes. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. So Mr. Singh Rodriguez, is that how do you go ahead and introduce yourself, and then I'll try to do better a second time. Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Chair Lily. My name is Abdel Sayek Rodriguez, and I serve as the executive director of Two Dance, a dance company and school located in St. Paul. And thank you for this invitation. Dance has been especially affected by COVID-19. It is highly a physical and athletic activity that cannot be social distanced and requires a space which cannot be recreated through video conferencing. For professional dancers, for students and their families, and for our audiences, these 2 years have meant significant loss. Two Dance has three primary areas of programming: professional dance performances for our loyal audiences in theaters like the Ordway and the O'Shaughnessy, training for youth and adults in our dance school in St. Paul, and community engagement to introduce dance at schools, libraries, and community centers. In the past 12 months, all three programming areas have been severely interrupted by the ongoing pandemic. Performances in theaters with large gatherings have been too high risk to plan, and so we delayed contracting our 10 professional dancers. Our school built flexibility using Zoom for students at home and using greater distancing at our studios. Even so, youth program enrollment is down by 57%, and families cite fear of infection and Zoom fatigue. Our adult programming is paused due to low enrollment. Two Dance was pleased to partner with Children's School in Minneapolis this fall for programming and dance. It was unfortunately our only community engagement for the past year. In a normal year, more than 2,500 additional Twin Cities students will have had their first dance experience through a Two Dance school or community engagement program. Overall, Two Dance operational budget have decreased 42%. While our earned income has decreased 78%. We serve a community highly represented by Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And Two Dance has been a leading voice in the arts for tackling social justice issues and providing access for people that have not been traditionally uplifted and amplified. This has been a year when our community needed us more than ever. Our resilience has been put to the test. We're proud to still be in operation while we hear national news on the closing of dance institutions. We have been strategically adapting and responding to the uncertainty in order to continue to inspire and serve the Minnesota community. Thank you for this opportunity. We're grateful for the support of the federal and local governments, private foundations, and individuals who continue to support and make our mission possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Saya Rodriguez. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we certainly want to, I'd love to hear all the outreach you're doing and other things and the challenges. Ms. Motes, good morning. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. Please help us with your story and experiences during the last couple of years, or certainly. Thank you. Good morning. Please introduce yourself when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Lily, and thank you, members of the Legacy Amendment Finance Committee. My name is Kim Motes. I am the Managing Director of Children's Theater Company. And I very much appreciate this invitation to speak with you this morning. Children's Theater Company is based in Minneapolis. We are the largest and most acclaimed theater in North America that serves a multi-generational audience with a focus on children and families. Pre-pandemic, we annually served 250,000 children and adults. We work with schools statewide to deeply impact tens of thousands of children throughout Minnesota each year to improve learning outcomes, social emotional development, and cultural competencies, among many other skills. When the shutdown happened in March 2020, we had to make the heartbreaking decision to furlough and lay off the majority of our staff to stay alive. We went from an annual payroll of 440 employees down to 27. From September 2020 through this past August, we turned our lobby into a food and supplies distribution center in partnership with CanMN and Pimento Relief Services to help over 100 families each week secure much needed supplies that included food, diapers, and other household needs. This past June, we were thrilled to resume our summer camps and classes in person with students wearing masks and social distancing, which meant lower class sizes. I'm proud that we served 811 students over 11 weeks and had zero cases of COVID in our students, our staff, and our teaching artists. However, because we served 50% fewer students, we had over $125,000 less in revenue. This past September, we enthusiastically recalled our furloughed staff back after 18 months, and 90% of our employees returned to CTC because of their commitment to our mission. We turned lights back on, checked speakers, saws, and sewing machines, and began the work of bringing the beloved musical Annie to our stage for the holidays. With tears in our eyes, our opening night was November 12th, 610 days from our last opening night. This holiday season, Annie ran 80 performances for 45,000 people until closing weekend on January 7th, when we had breakthrough cases of Omicron that resulted in four canceled performances of sold-out houses. We issued refunds for the run that totaled $200,000. We made it through 80 performances because of the testing protocols and COVID safety plans we had in place. Casts of actors and production crews are regularly tested three times a week. They wear masks at all times during rehearsal and backstage. All of our employees are vaccinated and wear masks in our building. We made significant improvements in our HVAC systems, including adding MERV 13 air filters and an ionization air purification system to all our air handling units. Our audiences age 12 and a half and older are required to show proof of vaccination or negative test, and everyone must wear masks at all times at CTC. COVID testing of our cast and production crews has been a significant expense and a requirement of our unions. This season, COVID testing alone will cost us over $96,000. Omicron has caused additional challenges for us in January. We opened a new play, which has experienced a sharp fall off of audiences willing to come out and gather in a theater. We had scheduled a 5-week performance run of Circus Abyssinia from Ethiopia. Due to visa challenges related to COVID and the civil war in Ethiopia, we had to postpone them to next fall. And we are concerned about the significant mental health challenges for our young people who need positive experiences where they can gather together, reduce their isolation, collaborate, and hear stories that build empathy and compassion. Many student field trips were canceled due to COVID and shortages of bus drivers. Those students who did attend our matinee performances of Annie were joyful, hopeful, and left the theater with optimism and smiles on their faces. Our story is consistent with most producing theaters during this time. The business resumption plans have been as successful as they can be amid a backdrop of new variants and their transmission through the air. We continue to remain as flexible and agile as we can be. And we daily say, flexible and agile, flexible and agile. The funding from the state of Minnesota Legacy Amendment and General Fund has been a lifeline and is essential for us to continue to serve Minnesotans with new productions and new programming. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Motes. It's a very compelling story there. Thank you for joining us this morning. Mr. Kropp, good morning. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Good morning, Thank you, Chairman Lee and members of the House Legacy Appropriations Committee. I'm Hal Kropp. I'm the producing artistic director of the Commonweal Theater Company, a small regional professional non-union company in Lanesboro, Minnesota, a town of 754. First, I want to thank members of the committee and indeed the entire legislature. Due to the support of the State Arts Board, the legacy funds, and all of the pandemic relief that you have authorized, we were able to keep our 14-member resident ensemble fully employed throughout the past 2 years, which is remarkable. Like everyone else in the country, 2020 forced us to go virtual. We ended up producing six virtual events and saw diminished attendance at all of those as people just kind of pivoted to Zoom and learning how to use the rest of the technology available. 2021, we planned and launched a full 5-production main stage season. We opened April 15th, and from April 15th through May 27th, performed under the state-mandated indoor performance venue guidelines, which resulted in an additional 2 hours daily trying to figure out how to get people safely into our 200-seat theater, grouping them in seatings by families, basically, which was an incredible burden. The 2021 season for us, normally we average about 185 performances. We actually scheduled 159 performances for 2021. And due to people's primary fears around COVID, our attendance declined from what is normally over 20,000 to 12,439 people in those 159 performances. That's a 42% decline in attendance. Our earned revenue was down 36%. And most importantly, we had to suspend our educational programs. We run an apprentice program where we take postgraduate theater artists who reside with us for a year and perform and learn how we function as a company. That program has been in hiatus for the past 2 years. We also had to put on hiatus our student matinee series, where we would bring in students from around the region. First, we would put an actor in their classroom for a workshop prior to their attendance, and then they would come. That normally saw about 5,000 students. Those two programs have been fully in hiatus. We also were unable to bring in artists from outside of the company. Normally, we bring in about 25 to 30 additional artists. We were only able to employ 5 outside artists. But because the ensemble resides here in Lanesboro, we are fully vaccinated. Our board put a mask mandate in. And I am proud to say that there has been no reported cases of COVID either in our employees or in any attendance member, audience member in attendance throughout 2021. So we spend about 5 hours a week massaging and working through our COVID protocols. That's a cost that is in excess of a normal operating cost. And we meet weekly, basically, to maintain our ability to be agile and flexible. Thank you, Kim, for that phrase. I think that's the essence of our story. Again, 42% decline in attendance, 36% decline in revenue, and a loss of about 20 to 25 jobs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kropp. And while all these stories are incredible, it's neat to hear all the great work that's going on. Is there any member questions at this point? Vice Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to all of our testifiers for sharing your stories of what has been a difficult few years. I think the common thread that I heard from all four of our testifiers is really, I was hoping to hear a little bit more about some of this youth programming, but I was kept thinking about how our legacy funding really does reverberate through our community beyond just promotion of arts and our cultural heritage. I heard every single person who's testified mention that they had to lay people off. And so those are huge job loss numbers. And I'm lucky enough to represent the Northeast Arts District. And I know many of my constituents were laid off and were not able to dance and act and sing and create in the ways that they had done before the pandemic, and they relied on that income. But I'm also thinking a lot about student mental health and the effects that the mental health has had on our children, whether it's not being able to go to dance class or not being able to go on field trips. We know that I also serve on the Education Finance and Education Policy Committees, and our students are reporting that their mental health is just cratered. So I'm wondering about some of those pivots in programming and youth outreach that have been done. I believe Mr. Rodriguez was speaking about some of the work he did at Sheridan, which is in my district. And I think that's a perfect place for 2Dance because it's a arts-focused Spanish immersion school. So can you tell me a little bit about what that program is and how that has changed during the pandemic?
Mr. Saya Rodriguez, could you hear the question?
Thank you so much, Representative Jordan. Yes, that program was supported by MSAB Arts Access that we got in 2019-2020. That was postponed due to COVID. And we finally were able to accomplish some of those activities in the fall 2021. We served 22 students who were invited to take classes at 2Dance Center, our school, every Saturday for a couple of hours. One of the hours was kind of a motivational, inspirational session with our artistic director, Tony Pierce-Sands. And the second hour was a dance class immersed in our school with our other students. They came to our space for 12 weeks. And then we have a final presentation showcase to their families at Sheridan on the 13th week. It was, as I said, this would have been a normal situation for us to do with our 14 partner schools in the Twin Cities. But unfortunately, that was the only one way that we could that we were able to achieve because we had the funding and we had all the precautions related to COVID.
Vice Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. I guess my final question for everyone would be, you all mentioned that you were able to pivot and be flexible and resilient. Would you have been able to do that if you had not had legacy funding or funding from the State Arts Board?
Any of you, the four of you, willing to take that?
I certainly can speak to that. I will say that without that funding, we would have had to lay off all, if not probably all, of the ensemble. And there are 14 of us who are making our living year-round working as artist administrators. So without that funding, 14 more people would have been on unemployment.
Ms. Motz, did you want to?
Thank you, Chair Lilly, Vice Chair Jordan. You know, the State Arts Board funding is absolutely critical to our funding mix. We would have failed to operate. I mean, in March of 2020, you have to realize we had no idea what was going to happen. We were all looking at our cash flow. That is a time of year where we're all fully in our seasons and in some ways at the lowest point of our cash picture, which is why we had to make really, really challenging decisions because we didn't know what the future was going to hold. And thanks to our donors, thanks stepping up, thanks to the State Arts Board and the legacy amendment, it was absolutely this lifeline for the entire industry because we are shut down. And in particular, the performing arts, it has taken us longer to get back up because of the very nature of what we do. And the fact that aerosols, when we learned that aerosols were, was transmitting COVID, I will tell you, we were in a session as an arts community with Dr. Michael Osterholm. And that's when we first learned about aerosols in May of 2020. And it was sobering. And we realized it was going to be a very long haul for us. I don't even want to imagine the loss of arts organizations and arts education programs and serving our young people and serving our state without this incredible resource. So thank you for it.
Thank you, Ms. Motz. Ms. Stearns, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly, Representative Jordan, and everyone. I would just echo what my two colleagues have said about the importance of the legacy funding, the State Arts Board funding, our Regional Arts Council funding. I can tell you, we would not be here without that. It was so crucial. And it allowed us to still connect to our community because there was a grant that became available that was called the Creative Support Grant. And that allowed us to still connect to our schools in the area and have artists talk with them and be with them. And even though it was remote and virtual, we were still able to bring those connections to the kids, and it was amazing. But it has been absolutely devastating. When we got that, I was on that same meeting Zoom with Kim Motz, my colleague, and when we heard from Dr. Osterheim about the aerosols, it was a stunned silence from all of us for a little bit as we're trying to cope. So yes, I wish you guys could see and understand how incredible the Legacy Amendment is, especially in Greater Minnesota. It is a game changer. Since 2008, we have been able to do so much more and go so much deeper with our constituents here. It's just been extraordinary. And so it's really scary and a little challenging to see how we can pivot and what we can do, because we are determined to be able to keep doing that, but we do definitely need that support.
Thank you, Ms. Stearns. And Mr. Saya Rodriguez, do you want to have a, we've had everybody else, I'd feel bad if we didn't have your voice as well.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. I think for all of us, are to be creative in leading artistic organizations and cultural organizations is part of our job. We have been certainly providing activities and reinventing what is our service to our community through these challenging times. We have had in Two Dance, for example, a very healthy way of getting funds through the government, through our private foundations, individual donors, and from our services. When our services or the revenue that we get from our services goes so far down as we have had, and for us to be providing very often at no cost services virtually to our community, the Legacy Fund became a game changer. In fact, two of our main activities in the last year and were supported by MSCB Arts Grant. One is the Arts Access Grant that we got, and this upcoming season for Two Dance is supported by the MSCB Arts Tour Grant that we received also in for 2020. So it has been incredibly helpful to be able to still support our people, our community, and to provide employment to the artists that keep, you know, creating and inspiring our youth.
Thank you. Well, Vice Chair Jordan, anything additional?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to everyone who's been here. Your stories are really important for, I think, both the health and well-being of our community. I look forward to hopefully seeing a show from all of you soon.
Thank you, Vice Chair Jordan. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate very much this conversation. And I was wondering if you have had any success getting partners from other state agencies. For instance, the Department of Education, the Department of Health, or the Department of Human Services, or the Department of Economic Development, or Public Safety, because those agencies all have been impacted also by the pandemic. And is it just expected that arts, the people in the arts world, have to pay for themselves and be their own partners forever? Or do you have partnerships with programs that are in each of those other agencies that I mentioned? and probably many more of the state agencies that I didn't think of off the top of my head.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I saw Ms. Motz is, go ahead if you have a comment.
Yep. Thank you, Chair Lilly. Representative Murphy, we actually have had partnerships with a number of state agencies. There's actually a group of about 70 arts and culture leaders that began meeting in May of 2020 and began right away with a contact in the governor's office. So we have regular meetings with Patrick Tanis in Governor Walz's office so that, and he helped connect us to a variety of state agencies. So for example, the Department of Health has come in many, many times over the pandemic to give us data and information about the pandemic to this group so that we could understand. I mean, I have joked that I feel like we've all become epidemiologists in order to run arts organizations right now because we've had to study this COVID-19 virus and understand it. The Department of Health has been essential in that. And we've had assistant commissioners and a variety of folks that have come in. Commissioner Grove and his team at DEED came in and heard from us about what we were experiencing. They have been hugely beneficial in helping with the unemployment insurance. We are reimbursers to the Unemployment Insurance Fund, and they heard our story. And like there was relief for the for-profit businesses, there were federal programs that helped the nonprofit sector, and the state also helped the nonprofit sector because of the incredible unemployment that was just, that would have been the next death nail to arts organization without that unemployment insurance reimbursement relief. The Department of Education came in July of 2020 and has since come in to talk with us so that we could understand from the education system what they were advising schools, what the realities were for schools, and so how we could best plan. Could we go back? Could we take teaching artists back into schools, or did we need to shift virtual? Which most of us shifted virtual, and we're serving going into classrooms in that virtual way. So they were incredible partners as we were sort of thinking about our own restart and reemerge and how it was going to work. So those are just a few examples mm-hmm. of the incredible public-private partnership that we have had. And this coalition of, 70 arts groups are absolutely from every corner of the state of Minnesota. It's actually been it's sort of a first for us in terms of just this regular coming together, and we're continuing to do it, and we don't want to let this group go, and I think all of us on this panel are part of that group. So thank you for that question.
Thank you
for that answer.
So I see no more hands. Representative Murphy.
I have another follow-up then, because you answered that one so well. How about, did you have any overtures or did you reach out to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, to the Clean Water Fund, to the Parks and Trails Fund, and have discussions about how the pandemic was affecting them? Or did they reach out to you, to the people in those funds, reach out to you to find out how you were struggling? And I would like an answer for every single fund that I name: Outdoor Heritage Fund, Clean Water Fund, Parks and Trails Fund.
I don't see so many hands on this one. Oh, here's one. Ms. Stearns.
I can address that to some degree. In Detroit Lakes, we have a recreational area called the Detroit Mountain. It's the DMRA, Detroit Mountain Recreational Area. And they have been recipients of some funding from the outdoor portion of the legacy amendment. And so, yes, in Detroit Lakes, all of us who manage nonprofits, we all support each other all the time and talk to each other and find out how we're being affected. Because, of course, they're primarily a ski hill. So they were, of course, shuttered and had a very different season than they thought they were going to have as well, and still are having difficulty getting workers and all of that as well. And so we do talk a lot in terms of reaching out and seeing how we can support each other and making sure that we can all get through this, because if each of us as nonprofits and the business community in general in our region are strong, we're all going to do better. We can all raise up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Anyone else, Mr. Chair? This is something, you know, I've been talking about for years.
Right.
That the funds are not independent little silos, and they should be concerned about working in each of the areas. And I'm disappointed if there's no more answers.
Ms. Moats has a comment. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Lilly and Representative Murphy. You know, I don't know that we know that there was sort of a formal sort of connection. I think that might be a question for the State Arts Board or Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. What I can tell you is for all of us, when we couldn't produce indoors, many of us produced outdoors. In parks. So I think the partnerships were likely more at the local level, as Amy Stearns was describing. I will tell you one example that I thought was hugely creative, that our partner, Chantel Dow at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids talked about, was in the summer, they actually had concerts where people pulled up their boats so that they could have social distancing in the lake. And they had concerts where the audience was in the water. In boats. And I thought that was incredibly creative and just another way that, you know, as Amy talked about, we are just, we are driven to serve our audience, serve our communities through the arts in any way possible. And that creative problem solving that we know is a benefit of the arts, we certainly saw that come fully to life when we couldn't produce inside our buildings.
Very good.
Mr. Saya. Rodriguez.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chair Lilly. And Kim just reminded me of exactly that. It's indirectly, but we have taken many times our students while the weather allows us to parks and take classes there. Community West African community classes for our students or their parents or their grandparents and friends. This last spring 2021, we were not able again to be in a theater celebrating the work of our students. And what we did is we went to Raspberry Island in close to downtown St. Paul, and we filmed there in their little stage our performance for our students. And the most beautiful thing happened, which is we have these little kids new to Two Dance Center who have only been taking class virtually. And for the first time, they were seeing each other after a year of taking classes. And it was the most beautiful thing we could ever imagine to have, for the first time, these little kiddos saying hello to each other and jumping around. So we created a dance for film from this project. And what it was just a filming opportunity outdoors to be safe and distant, it became this gathering of community and a celebration of the students getting to be with each other.
Representative Murphy.
I've completed my task.
Okay. So thank you for the great question, Representative Murphy and Vice Chair Jordan, questions. So we're kind of wrap up this section, and you know, we may hear back from you folks again as we move forward. I kind of had a question regards to a bill that many of us are working on, Senator Ruud and myself, and a lot of the members here have signed on to it for a rescue bill. It's $100 million that we're asking for to help you folks, you know, from the smallest of the to the groups to the largest, and try to help get some of the federal funds. Would that, just quickly, would that be something that would help you folks? Okay. Because so please, when you're meeting with the group of 70 or whatever with the governor, and I know Mr. Redmond and has worked with us with the bill, and then getting that to the governor and with you folks, and try to represent that. And that's not just in the arts area. That's I see Mr. Whitworth has his hand up too, and I think that helps, you know, all cultural groups. But anyways, please continue to advocate for that. I just really want to thank you all for coming out today and the work that you're doing, and it's just and then thinking outside the box, and I very much appreciate that. Next week, Representative Murphy, we're going to hear from Parks and Trails folks in Greater Minnesota. I know I heard some good report on what they're doing as far as introducing art to the parks that they are doing around the state. So that kind of fits right into it. So you're going to have an opportunity to hear that. I do see one more hand. I want to gather that. Representative Zhang, before we move on to the next grouping, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. Are we going to at some point hear back from the humanities about some of the BIPOC organizations that we were trying to fund last year too?
Certainly we can in the next couple of weeks. Next week we have kind of a full agenda, but I can talk to I'm getting nods from the vice chair, I'm getting nods from my staff, so we definitely can hear that, and that's our plan, is to hear kind of the broad breadth of how we're doing, and checking in and doing deeper dives into to all the funds. Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
Okay. Ms. Stern, go ahead.
If I may, Chair, I just wanted to follow up on that. I volunteered as a grant reviewer for the Minnesota State Arts Board for some individual artist support grants that were being put out for the BIPOC community and for Greater Minnesota. And you will be so amazed at the really neat programming that is being funded from that and for those individuals. It's really, really exciting. And then if I could also add, in regards to the park thing, one thing that we're doing here at the Holmes Theater is actually came out of the pandemic, is we're coloring the skies on Sunday with the Big Kite Festival. And that's a partnership with our county and our city and the Parks Department and everyone. And we've got 12 international kite flyers coming. And so that's just a neat way. And we're working with ECFE young preschool kids to do kites. And that's a kind of a neat collaboration also that I wanted to remind you all of in regards to how all the different groups are trying to work together. Thank you.
Well, again, thank you all for coming, and I'm certain you'll be open for further discussion as we continue to move through session. And but really, thank you for your leadership in our arts community. It's so vital to Minnesota and our quality of life. And as Representative Jordan, our mental health, our community, and certainly jobs. I have a underemployed musician in my house. So anyways, we got to get them out there. These band members. So thank you again. So we're going to kind of switch gears here and move over to the Minnesota Historical Society. Mr. Wentworth, thank you for joining us. And you kind of get a sense of where we're hoping to hear from you today, and kind of hear how you're doing, and what we can do better, and how you're meeting today's challenges and that sort of thing. So. Mr. Wentworth.
Great. Thank you, Chair Lilly. And before my colleagues from the other cultural organizations leave, I just wanted to thank them publicly for the inspiration that they have been to me personally and to our organization. MNHS has been fortunate to be in that group of about 70 cultural organizations from across Minnesota. And even this morning has been so uplifting, as I've heard from all four of you. And it's one of the reasons why it is such an honor to do this work here in Minnesota. We have a state legislature and a state government that gets it. We have a citizenry that gets it by, you know, evidenced by the legacy amendment, and then colleagues that are resilient, that are creative, that are innovative and persistent. And so before I started my remarks, I just wanted to let all four of you know how much you continue to mean to me and the Minnesota Historical Society. So thank you for the encouragement and the inspiration that just this morning you provided. Once again, we are grateful.
So, thank you. I'm glad you did start with that. Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I do not take that for granted. I've been in this field for more than 30 years, and frankly, Minnesota is, in many respects, the envy of so many states. Whether you're looking at it through the arts or history or the humanities, we are blessed to do this work in a state that is so committed to the importance of this work from an educational standpoint, an emotional standpoint, an economic standpoint. And so it's just been a privilege to be a part of this conversation this morning. So for the record, my name is Kent Whitworth, and I serve as the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Joining me this morning is David Kelleher, Director of Public Policy and Government Relations. Thank you so much for the opportunity to provide an update on year two of the pandemic in the Minnesota history world. First and most importantly, I'd like to express the history community's appreciation for the resources that this committee has provided to carry out this important work. As all of you know, the history community consists of organizations, large and small, doing history sometimes at the statewide level and other times with a much more local focus. Many doing this work actually may not even think of themselves as doing history as a primary focus of their work, but let me be clear, they are absolutely preserving and sharing and connecting our communities to their past. We have accomplished so much over the past 13 years, despite a number of bumps in the road these past 2 years. It's not a surprise to any of you that it's been a roller coaster. We've heard some of that in the last series of testimonies. And so much of this is tied to the twin effects of the pandemic and economic challenges. In the first year of the pandemic, we, along with many others, had a very abrupt shutdown. And that shutdown came just as we were heading into school tour season and our tourist season. But that abrupt shutdown forced closures of in-person activities and also demanded a full pivot to deliver history services digitally. And year two, the second year has been marked by what I would characterize as a gradual return to in-person activities. But clearly our visitor base is showing significant uncertainty, and the Minnesota history communities continuing to work to understand and to meet the demands of a new hybrid, partially digital world through which we deliver our mission. I'll come back to a few specific impacts of year two of the pandemic, but first I'd like to highlight some of the positive accomplishments of 2021 as shown in our legacy annual report. Members of the committee, you received a paper copy of the report. It was delivered to your Capitol office earlier this week, and an electronic version of our report is included in today's committee meeting materials. As we've done in previous years' reports, this document includes background information on appropriations in this biennium. It highlights the overall impact of history legacy grants. It includes a complete listing of all grants made in 2021, along with a listing of programs carried out by the Minnesota Historical Society. Chair Lilly and members of the committee, thousands of Minnesotans in the history community have persevered in these challenging times. And I'd like to highlight just two groups of people who epitomize this resilience that, frankly, we've celebrated throughout the morning. So when I think of resilience, I think of our National History Day students and our mentors and our teachers. As all of you know, thousands of History Day students each year do research on historical topics, and they present in a format of their choosing. It could be an exhibit, a performance, a creation of a website, a video documentary, or a traditional research paper. And typically, this is an in-person activity with mentors from MNHS providing individual assistance to History Day participants on how to do research with primary sources. Of course, over the last 2 years, History Day participants and History Day mentors and teachers have all demonstrated amazing flexibility and resilience to continue on in this important educational work, but in a virtual environment. And once again, Minnesota has served as a national model for History Day programs across the country. We were among the very first, literally in the course of about 48 hours, to pivot to a digital platform, to a digital delivery of our district and state History Day competitions. So we celebrate the History Day students and those teachers and those mentors. The second group that I'd like to highlight as epitomizing this resilience is the volunteer members of our Historic Resources Advisory Committee. We refer to them as the HRAC. And I'd also like to recognize my MNHS colleagues on staff who assist the committee with their work. This is an exceptional group of volunteers, and they're the ones that make the recommendations on legacy grants. And their work involves very serious deliberations in order to make very difficult decisions. I think you saw on one of the earlier slides that we have more than twice the number of requests that we're able to fund at this point. So there are very difficult decisions, and they take those deliberations very seriously. This volunteer committee has worked via Zoom, just as you have, in less than ideal circumstances. And we so appreciate these volunteers and their willingness to continue during the hard work that makes this process successful. Mr. Chair, it's my pleasure to highlight three projects in particular in this year's report that demonstrate the impact that legacy dollars have made. Frankly, it's really difficult to choose three from this entire booklet, so I do hope that all of you have a moment to look through the report in its entirety, and I want to encourage you to let us know if you've got questions about any of these projects and any of the work that goes on behind it in support of it. So the first project I'd like to highlight is in southeastern Minnesota. For thousands of years, people have taken chert. Chert is a rock used for spear points and other tools. They've taken chert from a quarry near the community of Grand Meadow and Moore County. This site has hundreds of pits. And this very specific variety of chert has been found at archaeological sites all around the region and beyond. So for thousands of years, people would come and take this chert and then take it back to their own respective communities, if you will. Today, the Moore County Historical Society, the Archaeological Conservancy, and the Prairie Island Indian Community are working together to preserve this very significant historic site. A legacy partnership grant is enabling these partners to develop interpretive materials to help visitors understand the site when it opens to the public in the very near future. So the second project takes us back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And the amateur photographer and St. Olaf College professor, O.G. Phaland, who took thousands of photographs in Northfield, which were preserved on glass plates. With the fragile nature of these glass plate negatives, it's difficult to use these photographs. Once again, a legacy grant permitted the St. Olaf College to conserve and digitize these very delicate glass negatives and make them available online. Another important component of this project is students, St. Olaf students, assisted in the cleaning and the cataloging of these glass negatives, working alongside conservation professionals. And finally, the third project I'd like to highlight is a partnership. The Minnesota Historical Society is proud to partner with the Capri Theater in North Minneapolis to present First Thursday Films. This is a film and discussion series bringing community together. And you'll see in the slide deck, Sign of the Times. This is a film documenting Prince's 1987 concert tour, and Sign of the Times will be presented on March 3rd. I've got a real personal interest. Chair Lilly, you may have a similar interest. I've got a personal interest, and I'm deeply looking forward to the presentation of 39 Seconds. And this is a documentary about Negro League baseball, and particularly it's a Minnesota story. But 39 Seconds will be shown during the upcoming baseball season at the Capri Theater. And the film will be followed by a panel discussion, which will include Frank White, author of a book published by the MNHS Press. And the book's entitled, They Played for the Love of the Game, Untold Stories of Black Baseball in Minnesota. So as we commemorate Black History Month, you can find many more resources. To learn more, I would encourage you to go to our website and you will see Black History, Black Voices. It's a designated section of the MNHS website full of resources to make this year's commemoration of Black History Month as meaningful as possible. So, Chair Lilly, if you don't mind, I'd like to return briefly to the impacts of the pandemic, particularly in the second year. At the Minnesota Historical Society, we have worked to reopen a number of locations across our historic site network, and we've adjusted schedules to meet audience demands and visitation patterns. It's not going to be a surprise to any of you that locations with outdoor focus, we were just talking about this, locations with an outdoor focus and those in high tourism areas have kept very busy as we've reopened. And Split Rock Lighthouse is a good example of meeting these two conditions in terms of an outdoor kind of orientation in a high tourism area. Jeffers Petroglyph is another great example where we've seen record-setting attendance because of its outdoor orientation and the significance of the story of those petroglyphs. There is one major uncertainty, and that is what school groups will be doing in calendar year 22 and certainly beyond. We all know that teachers and students have been under excruciating stress. And the mission of historical organizations across our state is to educate people of all ages. But we have a special duty to help with the history education of our young people. And we certainly are hopeful that school groups, that field trips will return in calendar year 2022. But frankly, this chapter is unfolding and we don't have a clear line of sight on that just yet. Kim was talking about the great resources that the Department of Education has been, and we've talked about field trips and their likelihood of returning. So this is a huge area of concern for all of us in the Minnesota history community, and I wanted to name that. One final area of concern is the very unusual labor market. We at MNHS have had staff members depart for a variety of reasons, but often that's due to better salaries in other sectors. And on the flip side, hiring has been a challenge. We have fewer applications for job openings, and in many cases, we're competing in very highly competitive markets, such as IT and finance, where frankly, others can pay a great deal more than we can. So that's a trend that emerged during the pandemic that we are in the midst of trying to manage and strengthen our position. All of these things have slowed our work down. Many of the projects, many of the legacy funded projects have taken longer to complete, and we have adapted to meet rapidly changing conditions and expectations from audiences. But I am proud to say that through it all, the Minnesota history community and the Minnesota Historical Society in particular has remained focused on serving the people of our great state. To that end, in 2021, we approved an ambitious five-year strategic plan where we tweaked the mission statement so that the first phrase is, we serve all the people of Minnesota, those who have been here for generations and those who are just beginning their journey here. A few of the key goals from this plan include pushing history to all corners of Minnesota, sharing authority and expertise, and partnering with communities and organizations. These are hallmarks of where we are headed over the next 5 years. And frankly, the legacy amendment funds are enabling us to do this and to share funds across the Minnesota history community. And finally, another highlight and accomplishment in 2021 is that the Minnesota Historical Society was reaccredited by the American Alliance of Museums. This is a designation that is reserved for institutions that model the very highest level of commitment to best practices in our field. It's sort of a good housekeeping stamp of approval, if you will. I'm dating myself using that term, but some of you will know what I'm talking about. The site review committee, and they spent about a week with us in late August, they wrote in their final report, and I quote, while the environment in which all museums operate has changed dramatically, the Minnesota Historical Society has adapted appropriately and thoughtfully to these pressures and changing circumstances. So we are proud of the work that we've been able to accomplish in the midst of the pandemic. We have partners in all corners of the state, large and small, that are doing great history in all the communities that are represented by this committee and far beyond. So thank you again for your continued support. David and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Whitworth. And if all members have received the copy of your report, and we have quite a few reports that we're getting, it's super exciting, and yours is very thorough. And I don't envy you trying to reduce it to three little stories, but boy, they're good ones. I had a quick question before I get to member questions. What happens with your exhibits? I know Legacy helped with the Hmong exhibit that you did and the Somali exhibit. Does that become part of your permanent exhibit, or do you forward that on to a Somali museum or a Hmong museum? Or how do we, I'd hate to see those treasures in a basement or
right.
Like Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of thing.
Yes. Well, and so many of those collections, that go into those temporary exhibits. Some come from the MNHS collection, some are loaned from the community. So at the end of those temporary exhibits, the artifacts themselves go back to the individuals or the institutions they're from. But the exhibit components, in fact, it's interesting, I'll mention the strategic plan. We are retooling our entire exhibit program to have a greater focus on communities across Minnesota rather than nationally traveling exhibitions. Uh-huh. So we're in the midst of that transition, but we are more and more able to take components of these temporary exhibits and repurpose them or share elements of them with local organizations. But Chair Lilly, another place where these stories live on is digitally. And for example, we just closed Extraordinary Women, and that is an incredibly robust website that has much more depth and breadth than the physical exhibit could have. Where the exhibit focused on a couple of dozen stories, the online version captured well over 50 stories. And so we look at it as a stewardship issue. And so thank you for bringing that up. We are making progress, but that is a cornerstone of really expanding access of component of our strategic plan. So look forward to talking even more about that in the future.
I'm good. Good. I'm happy to hear they live on. I mean, one of the things that you do so well up there is the kind of the display. It's, to tell a greater story than just the artifact.
Yeah.
So thank you. Any member questions? I know Representative Zhang was asking about some of the grants, but I don't see him at this time. Vice Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. And thank you to the Historical Society for being here. A question I have is, when you're talking about digital assets and making sure that those live on for education and I guess entertainment purposes, I think it's fun to look at your website. How do you interact with SHPO and state historical resources as well? Is there an overlap there? I know they have been seeking funding in the past to digitize more of their records, but what is your relationship with SHPO, I guess, would be my question.
Mr. Wentworth.
Chair Lilly, Vice Chair Jordan, I'll make a few initial comments and then turn to my colleague, David Kelleher, who's got a much longer history. We, as you know, the State Historic Preservation Office was part of MNHS for a number of years, but even as that has gone to the Department of Administration, we continue to work closely with them on a variety of projects. And I can tell you from my days in Kentucky, the State Historic Preservation Office had the same challenge of digitizing those records that were in support of all of those federal programs that SHPOs across the country manage. So I'm familiar with the challenge, but more in a Kentucky context rather than the Minnesota one here. So David, I don't know if you want to, if you have more line of sight on that challenge and how we're working with them.
Thank you. Mr. Kelleher, welcome. Go ahead. I'm sure you heard the question, and please give us your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. I think Kent summed it up pretty well that the State Historic Preservation Office, of course, used to be part of Minnesota Historical Society, but no longer is. There are lots and lots of historical records that they have. We obviously continue to have lots of information in our collections, whether it's artifacts, archaeological components, and we work very closely with SHPO, with the Office of the State Archaeologist, to make sure that this information is usable for whichever user group. Obviously, the archaeology information has a important user group in the archaeology community, but we work very closely with all of those folks to make sure that that information is as accessible as it possibly can be.
Vice Chair Jordan.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Representative Murphy, I see your hand here. Looks like you have clear blue skies up in the Northland.
With snow, spots of snow trailing down from the heavens. I did have a half hour out sweeping the sidewalk this morning before light, but it looks like I might have to do it again tonight. But I wanted to ask about David Kelleher just said a little bit. Did I hear you, David, say that, or Mr. Kelleher, say that the Minnesota Historical Society Press is no longer part of Minnesota Historical Society?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, no, Minnesota Historical Society Press is very much with us and very active and doing amazing work with putting out the magazine and, you know, 20 or 30 book titles each year. Yep, I'm surrounded by them and I bet you are too. And we both have a love of books and they're very much with us. Yep. The State Historic Preservation Office is no longer part of the Minnesota Historical Society.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm glad I clarified that because my question is about the Historical Society Press. How is a decision made of what they are going to publish? Or you said 20 or 30 copies of various books throughout the year. How does one submit and how do is the selection made for what will go? And then who gets the money? Because they're for sale. I have a blue ribbon one in my hand right now from about the state fair over the years, and that's 30 years old or however old it is. That was $24.95 then. Who gets the money?
Mr. Kelleher, before we get to his answer, Ms. Representative Murphy, you got to hold it in the middle in front of you because we lose it in the, or I don't know how you do it. We lose it. It's totally gone with the.
It's not important.
It is, though.
There's many more books since this one.
Okay.
And the state fair has gotten a lot bigger.
Mr. Kelleher, did you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we have a staff in MNHS Press, which is comprised of editors and marketers and others, and they sometimes will take in suggestions from authors who initiate ideas. They will sometimes initiate an idea for something they think would be a good book and then go out and either find an author or work with groups out in the public. So it's a combination of ideas flowing back and forth from the staff, and then the staff editors will work with authors and refine a book concept and a book itself. And then the long process of editing and then going into the design and production, printing and sales, that's what they do. That's what a publisher does. As far as the funding for the book or the proceeds from the book, those go back into the press. And because we do a variety of titles, from very serious scholarly books, which are important to do, but maybe don't make a lot of money, to more popular books that might make a little bit more money. We are not doing New York Times top 10 bestseller list, but we're doing the important work of documenting Minnesota history, where it's, again, important work, but maybe not as financially lucrative as other areas of the publishing world.
So then the author of the books that are sold, then they get a stipend from you.
Mr. Chair, correct. The author will receive some funding. It obviously costs a fair bit to produce the book itself. The book you have there is a hefty, heavy book with a lot of wonderful pictures that bring back great memories of the state fair. That particular book is not cheap to produce, and then distribution and marketing all go into the process as well.
Well, thank you, Mr. Kelleher, and thank you for the questions this morning. Mr. Withworth, thank you very much for coming. We very much appreciate it, and I know that you're available for further questions, whether it's via email or phone call or another opportunity to come over and visit. I'm hoping to have our committee have an opportunity to go over and tour. So hopefully you're open to that and have some. And we've talked about that in the past, and hopefully during session we can sneak over there for some of these local stops. Again, members, we're going to be doing this as we go through session. We're going to kind of move through all the funds and appreciate the questions. And again, thank you for your time. I forgot to mention my new committee legislative assistant, Sam O'Neill. Welcome. And certainly he's available for any questions that members might have. And again, thank you, everybody, for your time this morning. And it was great to hear from our art folks, the great work that they're doing, and also the good work that's going on with the Historical Society. So we'll see you again next week. And again, thank you, everyone. Have a good day.